Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Can you hear it?
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty! We are free at last!
It's the voice of prophecy. So too is this, says cultural critic Grill Marcus.
High water rising, 6 inches above my head. Coffins dropping in the street like balloons made out of lead. What I poured into Vicksburg, don't know what I'm gonna do. Don't reach after me, she say, can't you see I'm drowning too? It's rough out there. High water everywhere.
American prophets, says writer Grill Marcus, from Abraham Lincoln to Martin Luther King to Bob Dylan, have not so much foretold the nation's future as cast a light on its contradictory heart, liberty and slavery, humility and hubris, high ideals and low-down power plays. This hour on Point, Grill Marcus on American prophecy and prophets, from Puritan John Winthrop to filmmaker David Lynch, novelist Philip Roth, and much more. Joining me now from New York is renowned cultural critic Grill Marcus. He's a former editor at Rolling Stone. His 1975 book, Mystery Train, is credited with redefining rock music criticism. It placed rock and roll in the context of American cultural archetypes, from Moby Dick to Jay Gatsby to Stagger Lee. His new book is The Shape of Things to Come, Prophecy and the American Voice. Grill Marcus, welcome. It's so great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
It's good to be with you.
So, you're talking about prophecy, but you don't want to talk about soothsaying. It's not just seeing the future. What do you mean when you say prophecy?
From the beginning of America as an idea, as a place settled by Europeans, from the time of the Puritans on down, people have seen themselves as part of a mission and of having made a covenant that they had to live up to. For the Puritans, a covenant with God, with the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, became defined as a covenant that we all make with each other to live up to certain promises. This is what the children of Israel did. And in the Old Testament, you find Jeremiah, Isaiah, Amos saying, you betrayed your covenant. You've betrayed the promises you made to God and to yourselves. And because you are the chosen people, you will be punished beyond anyone else.
You remind us of the voice of God from the book of Amos in the Old Testament, the Bible calling out to the children of Israel, you only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. That kind of right down to the prophecy of responsibility, because God knows them.
Exactly. So what the prophet does, rather than saying this will happen if you do this, this will be the consequence, the prophet says, calls people to judgment, says you will be judged. What's so different about the United States is that, unlike the story in the Bible, and yet edging toward it, even with the Puritans, is that we have to judge ourselves. As this is a covenant we made with each other, we can't look to God or anyone else to render judgment on our failings, our betrayals, or our successes in keeping the promises we've made. Mm. We have to make that judgment for ourselves, both as a people and each one of us in a solitary way. And while this was a great story in American political rhetoric through most of the 19th century, since then, I think you find artists working out this dilemma.
I mean, it's a fascinating thing in the book. At a moment, here we are the day after 9/11, people thinking about judgments from on high and elsewhere. You look back to the great promises that you say define America, promises of liberty and justice and equality. And I was fascinated. I mean, here you are saying, as you just say, in the 19th century, politicians speaking directly to these and frequently to these, Abraham Lincoln above all. But then the gap between lip and cup, the sort of shortfalls become so great at some point between founding ideals and the history of shortcomings, maybe inevitable, that it becomes hard for politicians to talk about. It passes, as you say, to artists.
Well, it seems to me that when Abraham Lincoln gave his second inaugural address in 1865 with the Civil War nearing its end but not over, and he became the American prophet, defined the role beyond anyone else in terms of what anyone else has been able to live up to or inhabit. But he made a statement. He called down a judgment that was so extreme and so terrifying that it blew this form of speech up. He said that if the war had to continue until every drop of blood drawn by the lash of slavery had to be repaid by blood drawn by the sword of the Civil War, then that's the way it would be. And nobody knows how you measure blood. The war ended, but was it in balance? Of course not. And so,
but the president, a prophet, as you say, was prepared to see, in the sort of Vietnam era phrase, prepared to sort of burn the nation in order to save, maybe not the nation, but its soul.
Exactly. And also laid a curse on the country for the violation, for its own betrayal. The thing is about America. We pledge ourselves to liberty, to justice for all, to equal justice before the law for every person. And the liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the chance to realize yourself, to become who you want to be. No other nation has ever made these kinds of promises. And these promises are so vast, they're so big, they're so beautiful, that their betrayal is inevitable. There's no way anybody could always, or even most of the time, live up to these things. And yet these ideals remain what define us, and our betrayals are the engine, the source of energy that keeps the ideals alive. Because we turn to each other again and again, and we say, look at this horrible violation of who we're supposed to be.
It doesn't match up to the city on the hill.
It doesn't match up to, you know, the nice street we want to live on, or for that matter, the awful, convulsive, scary, but always surprising street we might want to live
and
on.
And at a certain point, the contradiction becomes so great it's hard for politicians to continue to articulate it. Maybe climaxed all the way back with Abe Lincoln, but it passes to artists. We want to hear you take us through. I mean, you are all over the artistic map following this skein, but begin to take us in. Who do you see picking up the torch of prophecy? And give us some examples.
Well, the way the book I've written unfolds is that after looking at John Winthrop of the Puritans, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, we go to Philip Roth and the novels he wrote in the late 90s and in the early part of this century, American Pastoral, I Married a Communist, The Human Stain, The Plot Against America, where it seemed to me that he was contriving characters who were living out this destiny, this burden of idealism, of creating yourself. We started out to invent a nation, and in Philip Roth's books, that challenge becomes the challenge to invent yourself, to become a nation that you carry within yourself. And so character after character, particularly the Swede in American Pastoral, but also Coleman Silk in The Human Stain and many, many more, become walking Americas, each on his own terms, and each meets with absolute disaster. Each meets with tragedy.
Philip Roth describing self-satisfied Americans, and in the end, describing, in his words, the extreme innocence was the corruption, that almost deliberate innocence, deliberate blindness to the contradictions that we have to live with as Americans.
Well, that's a wonderful line from The Human Stain, where these three professors at a college in New England are talking about Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, and one says she was totally innocent and totally corrupt, and then says, you know, in a flash of insight, the innocence was the corruption. In other words, when we say to ourselves that we're innocent, that we never had a bad thought, that our motives were always pure, that God has always been on our side, nothing is more corrupt than the refusal to see that you yourself can carry evil, that you yourself can wish for the worst and do the worst. All human beings have that capacity. God knows the Puritans understood it. But that's something that, with the Declaration of Independence and its picture of a great sunburst, really, we've forgotten.
We're talking this hour with cultural critic Grill Marcus about American prophecy and prophets, from Lincoln to Bob Dylan to Philip Roth and David Lynch and more. His new book is The Shape of Things to Come, Prophecy and the American Voice. I want to get the words, if not the voice, we don't have that, of one of his big political prophets, Abraham Lincoln, in our ears. Here's a bit of the Gettysburg Address, just to remind us, read by singer Johnny Cash.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this.
Abraham Lincoln's words of the Gettysburg Address, read there by Johnny Cash. Grill Marcus, you point right back to Lincoln as maybe the biggest challenger as a prophetic voice, and then you move ahead. And I wish you'd begin to take us. I mean, you're kind of pinball wizard of connections here between different artists, different voices. Begin to take us through that skein of voices that you then look to in the realm of artists for American prophecy.
Well, we were talking about Philip Roth before, and after Philip Roth, in the story as I tell it, comes David Lynch, who's a tremendously transgressive, shocking, unpredictable filmmaker. Someone who, you know, is lying in the gutter not because he sees the stars reflected there, but because he is thrilled by the filth.
That's Blue Velvet. This is Twin Peaks. Much more.
Right. And in this book, I focus on a number of movies: Lost Highway with Bill Pullman, the Twin Peaks television series, but most of all, Fire Walk with Me, which is a prequel to the Twin Peaks series that was made afterwards with the great actress Cheryl Lee. And here you see him offering characters who are absolutely alone, for whom society and the nation itself has ceased to exist except as a kind of chimera, as a kind of something you see in the fog. And that's the story that you find in the movies that David Lynch makes, that someone walks into a world where everything is supposed to be possible, into America, where freedom is everyone's birthright, and then suddenly you're ambushed. And this becomes a drama where people lose themselves.
Because there's no there. The thing you're counting on, the bedrock, you turn around and it's gone. I mean, you quote Herman Melville, Moby Dick, you know, the famous line, just, and it made me think, of course, of 9/11, saying, "The ship, great God, where is the ship?"
Well, you know, the day or so after the terrorist attacks in 2001, There were a number of voices collected by the New York Times, and one was someone who had come out of the World Trade Center that was still standing, and he looked for the other one, and it wasn't there. Mm. And he said, where is it? Where is the building? And Herman Melville was right there writing his words, was standing behind him, prompting him. That's how it felt. In other words, that we all carry within us the notion that this nation could disappear at any moment. It's an idea, and that's what's kept it alive. That's why we love it. That's why we are filled with horror and disappointment over it. But we all know that it is a kind of illusion. It is a kind of mystic garden. And someone can sneak up behind us and hit us over the head at any time. And there's a way in which that's what happens in the David Lynch, Bill Pullman, Cheryl Lee chapters in this book. You see that drama played out, and yet with images here and there of American beauty, American perfection, where you understand the pull of liberty and why to fail to become as free as the Gettysburg Address, you know, challenges to be, is a betrayal of the whole country. It's very funny. You play Johnny Cash reading the Gettysburg Address, and of course Johnny Cash has a very deep voice. Abraham Lincoln had a very high voice. It was even called girlish. Mm-hmm. And in a class I taught this spring at Berkeley, when we came to his second inaugural, I asked one of the women in the class to read it out loud, to get maybe a little closer to how it really sounded.
Did it change the impact somehow?
I think it did a lot, because, you know, we think of Lincoln or any president in the deep past as this much larger-than-life figure.
Godlike.
Who just exudes authority, as opposed to somebody who in his time was mocked, reviled, generally shown in editorial cartoons as a chimpanzee.
Kind of a scarecrow, a searcher, not the voice of God in his own day. Grill Marcus, it is so tremendous to have you. Lots of listeners want to join this conversation. We're talking about American prophecy. Let me turn to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello there.
What do you think,
Hi
Tom?
There.
I was wanting to respond to your question, who do I see as being current-day prophets. And part of my hope is that among those voices are traditional voices that come from many different faith traditions that seek to look hard at those faith traditions to their messages about justice, and about an orientation to the other, about personal rights that stand against the power of tyranny, what have you. And as I'm a Presbyterian minister, I hope always that in my work, both in my preaching but also in just the work I do in this sort of living witness, that the voice of prophecy that comes out of, in my case, the Christian tradition, and I think the radical teachings in there about justice, that those come through as a part of that dialogue using, shall I say, an ancient rhetoric, but
Tom, Pastor Tom, I will put that to Grill Marcus, but let me ask you, while we've got you from Albuquerque, one of the voices that the Grill cites in response to 9/11 comes from a Christian quarter, sort of famously or infamously, Reverend Jerry Falwell, and this was 2 days after 9/11, saying this is probably what we deserve. The abortionists have got to bear some burden for this because God will not be mocked. He said, I really believe that the pagans, the abortionists, the feminists, and the gays and lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who have tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen. Is that the voice of faith that you're speaking to, Tom?
It would not be the voice of my faith. I see that actually as a slap in the face of what I hear as a message, Jesus's message of a deep concern for all people, and God not being a God of vengeance, but a God of justice who seeks reconciliation and to build up and doesn't seek to destroy. And so while I recognize that as being part of the voice of modern Christianity, I see it as one that, in my opinion, distorts the true or central message of Jesus' call to justice and liberty and orientation to all peoples.
Minister Tom, thank you for your call. Grill Marcus, what about the God of justice in American prophecy and voices of faith in particular?
You know, a God of justice is going to be a God of vengeance. A God of justice is going to have many faces, and that's going to be one of them. And it depends on how the people who speak for us or who we decide might speak for us translate that voice. In Amos, when he says, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream," he's not talking about a cleansing bath of goodness. He's talking about vengeance. He's talking about destruction. He's talking about a flood that will wash everything away, as in the Dylan song we started with, "High Water Everywhere." This is not going to be any fun.
So Jerry Falwell, as an American prophet, in your view, do you put him in the lineage of Amos and Isaiah?
No, not in the slightest, because you know I don't think he's a serious person. I think he's simply a power player. He's a politician. I don't think of him as a preacher at all. When Martin Luther King used those same words from the prophet Amos, in his great address to the March on Washington in 1963 that we heard the very end of at the beginning of the program, when he quotes those words, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness as a mighty stream," he is promising the people before him, the whole nation, its past, present, and future, that they will be cleansed and they will walk into a new day as new men and women ready to live up to the promises they've made. Now, Martin Luther King was one of the most eloquent men or women in the history of this country, whereas Jerry Falwell is just a thug.
Eloquence comes in many forms. You point to Allen Ginsberg as a poet and kind of prophet, too. Let's listen to him reading from his poem, Howl.
"I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night, who, poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high, sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz, who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs, illuminated, who passed through universities with radiant, cool eyes, hallucinating Arkansas and Blake Light tragedy among the scholars of war."
Allen Ginsberg reading from his poem, Howl. Let's take a call from San Francisco, California. Dave, Diamond Dave is on the air. Hi, Dave. What do you think?
Hey, you know, I'm kind of the generation between the young Ginsberg and Bob Dylan. For me, I want to go back to a generation just before. I want to mention three names. You can take either of the three. Henry Miller, Kenneth Rexroth, and Kenneth Patchen, I think, were three who brought it from the mainstream to the edge in the tradition of the Wobblies, the IWW, a rebellion, a democracy in the American way.
Grill Marcus, there's the voice between Ginsberg and Dylan with his list of prophets. What do you say?
Well, you know, I know Dave. Dave and I go way back, and it's wonderful to hear his voice because there's no time when he himself doesn't get on the radio or up on a stage and call down this sense that anything can happen, that judgment might be looking us in the face or stalking us from behind at any moment. You know, he's entering into the conversation.
And he points to Henry Miller. Did you point there for prophecy yourself, Grill?
No, not me. Those are voices he hears. They aren't voices I hear. But the book I wrote is hardly meant to be definitive or exclusive. It's just saying, in this country, you can hear this kind of voice everywhere. And it just depends on what trips you up as you walk down the street? So it's Kenneth Patchen, Kenneth Rexroth that pulls at Dave's heels and others who pull at mine.
Dave, thanks for your call. Judy is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Judy, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to suggest that the broken covenant sort of that you've been talking about that America chose to do with earlier than the Civil War was with the Native American Indians, and that we are there is judgment for the wrongs that we've done, and in ways that Jerry Falwell would never dream. There are judgments for the policies of America that we, that the politicians, you know, for economic reasons and for power reasons and everything else. There are judgments that, because there are consequences that reach way past the generation of the decision.
You point all the way back to Native Americans and their treatment. Do you feel us living within that judgment now, Judy, in Nashville?
I certainly do. I certainly do. And in fact, the destruction goes on with the fetal alcohol syndrome and everything else. There's a Native American artist named Bill Miller, who I would put up as one of the modern-day prophets that speaks to. He's actually a Christian, comes from the Christian tradition, but he sees that tradition from the eyes of the Native American Indian, which is just about completely opposite of anything Jerry Falwell would say.
Judy in Nashville, thanks very much for your call. That broken covenant is one that certainly people who sit in churches hear about plenty. And you say, Grill Marcus, it's the issue that the American prophecy really revolves around all the time.
Well, it's interesting the way that Judy frames this question. D.H. Lawrence, in his book Studies in Classic American Literature, writes that there is no square foot of earth that one can walk on in America without walking on corpses, and by which he means the corpses of Native Americans. He said the American soul is hard, stoic, isolate, and a killer, that this is a nation of murder.
But what about those beautiful ideals that walk above that?
Well, in Alice Walker's novel Meridian, there is a black man, the father of the main character, who is absolutely tortured by what America did to the Indians.
Sarah's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling because I just wanted to make a comment that I think it's a terrible shame that that these days our present-day prophets aren't readily available to us. I believe as a result of the corporate-run media, people like Anita Franco and Bill Hicks and Michael Fronte all have things to say that I believe we should all be able to hear, but that's just not really possible in this day and age.
Is it because they're screened off or because Americans don't want to hear them?
No,
Sarah?
I think there's a problem. I think that Americans would want to hear them. I just don't think that we're able to. Yes, because they are screened.
Sarah, thanks for calling. Grill, what about it? Sarah wants to let the water flow down from heaven a little more fulsomely here. More voices. Do you see them, American prophets, actively cordoned off now?
No, I don't. I mean, Sarah has found these people. Sarah has found these voices that speak to her and that seem to speak for the whole country. One of the central arguments in the book, one of the pictures that was the most fun to paint was of David Thomas and the punk band from Cleveland, Pere Ubu, that's been out there now for 30 years. David Thomas has always played the role of the crank prophet, the guy who's standing on the corner raving, and people turn away embarrassed and hope that they can get past him without having to hear what comes out of his mouth. But, you know, a couple of people gather around. By the time you pass that corner again, there are 20 or 30 people listening, and you stop to hear what they might be hearing, and soon you're sucked in. Or else he's the guy in the alley saying, hey, do you really think you know what's going on? You know, I could tell you things. And that's the voice he's played with as a performer, as a singer, as a band leader for 30 years. And it's become an extraordinarily compelling voice.
And I suppose it's always been the prophet in the desert. But Sarah's question, I'm sure, is shared by other people. Do you not see? I suppose people always want to turn their ears and eyes away from prophets because prophecy is hard. But you don't see a screen on it. You don't see a particular isolation of it. I mean, the Black Eyed Peas and Beyonce don't have any trouble getting big audiences. Is that because of corporate, you know, evil, or is that just the age-old thing? We don't want to see the hard message.
No, I just think there are times when messages that in other periods of history would have been utterly unacceptable become what people want to hear. Screening doesn't bother me in the sense that we're talking about. I don't see mm-hmm. anything wrong in a democracy for us having to go out to search for the voices that speak to us, and when we find them, keep listening. I don't think we have any reason to expect that people who are telling us the hardest truths are going to show up in our living room shaking our hands and telling us that we're fine people for listening to them.
Let's take a call from Chicago. Davis is on the line. Hi, Davis. You're on the air.
Hi, fellas. I just was calling in because I'm actually in the midst of reading this fantastic book, The Team of Rivals by, I forget the author, but it's about
Doris Kearns Goodwin. We had her on yesterday. Yeah, it is a terrific book. And Abraham Lincoln and the men around him, what's it make you think, Davis?
Well, it's one thing that I recall most just right to my mind is that, you know, this guy Seward that was, you know, in his cabinet mm-hmm. was always calling on the higher law. And that seemed to really condemn his political career in a lot of ways because he was calling on this higher law. And then you had this guy Chase, for governor of Ohio, who's calling on people's conscience to sort of guide the way that they act politically and the way that they, you know, are Americans.
And what about Honest Abe in the midst of all that?
Well, see, it seems like Honest Abe was calling on, actually the quote that I thought was that, you know, the writer suggests that somebody in critiquing his speeches said that he would make speeches that made the public feel as though they were thinking out loud themselves.
Yeah, how we could use that. Davis, it's a great point. Grill Marcus, let us go from that to this issue of politicians and prophecy. You say they've moved away from it. What does that mean? When you had Abe Lincoln as a prophet, but also as president, in the end he straddled the gap. In the end he died in that gap between our aspirations and our reality. But he did end slavery. He had that kind of worldly power, not just the prophet's voice in the desert.
Well, you know, he didn't come into office as president to end slavery. As the Civil War went on, he began to see that war, that conflict, in greater and greater terms. And he began to see America itself as a missionary for the world. And if America itself could not be true to itself, then obviously it could only lie to the rest of the world. And so ending slavery became the only way the country could preserve itself. When the violations of the covenant, of the promises we've made to ourselves, become too great, then the national soul shrivels. And so it's one thing for Seward to call on a higher law, but it's really a deeper thing for Chase to say we must look to our own consciences, we must look to the higher law within each of us. That's a stronger argument. But when it comes to Lincoln, you know, we don't get people who have the depth and grandeur of Abraham Lincoln coming by every few mm-hmm. years, mm-hmm. every generation. Mm-hmm. A nation is lucky if it gets one Lincoln in the whole span of its history. Scoundrels, frauds, tricksters, liars, they're easy to find.
But you describe this great migration of American prophecy out of the realm of politics into the realm of poets. What are the implications of that? Politicians can turn around and act, as Lincoln did to end slavery, that they can act on the discrepancy between our ideals and our reality. Poets don't have their hands on as many levers.
You know, I wonder if Abraham Lincoln had not been assassinated, if he had not become a martyr to his own cause, if slavery could in fact have been ended. Because that battle would not have ended with the defeat of the South. And yet his death sanctified his own acts, and they couldn't be questioned. You know, we live in a nation of paradoxes. We live in a nation of mystical happenstance. where we don't know how anything might have turned out differently. And, well, you know, when you look to poets, maybe that means that people will listen to each other. Poets will listen to politicians. Politicians will listen to poets, and not just to quote them.
We've got our ears wide open for American Prophecy in this hour with Grill Marcus. His book is The Shape of Things to Come. Scott's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Love the show. Glad to be on.
Glad to have you, Scott. What do you think?
So many things here. First of all, I'd like to just say hi to Sarah in Des Moines and say there's another Bill Hicks fan here in Iowa. So
there's a club.
He's not completely marooned. I'm calling because I guess there's two threads running parallel here, the prophecy of believers and the prophecy of thinkers. And our world seems to be really at odds, you know. I guess it always has been, but, you know, today as well, the thinkers versus the believers, I guess. And the two people that I wanted to talk about were Bill Hicks, a late great comedian from Texas who died about 12 years ago, and Jello Biafra of the punk band The Dead Kennedys. And those two guys mean a lot to me these days because they had a lot to say about the rise of the religious right and the intertwining of that type of religion with the militarism in the world. And I go back and I listen to songs like Moral Majority and When You Get Drafted by The Dead Kennedys, and they sound like they could have been written, you know, 3 months ago, as does a lot of the things that Bill Hicks talked about regarding the first Gulf War and the first Bush and Saddam Hussein. And it's just, it's amazing, it's perplexing that we just seem to go round and round in circles with these issues as human beings.
But there you are, listening for that prophecy. Let me put that to Grill Marcus, if I may. Scott, what about it? Scott's putting believers and thinkers in two different camps. Are you precluding believers from the realm of thinkers, and does it make a difference in the kind of prophecy that either produces?
That's not the way I hear it at all. When I hear someone who seems to contain within himself or herself a prophetic voice, a sense of judgment, a sense of calling us all to judgment, I also hear doubt. I also hear that person speaking, acting, gesturing in a way that says, I'm not sure. This is my sense. This is the possibility I want to put before us, but I don't know. And you certainly find that sense of doubt in Winthrop as to how the great adventure of the Puritans is going to turn out.
Mm-hmm. Four in centuries Lincoln, back, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Lincoln, saying he doesn't know what the fate of this nation is going to be. In Martin Luther King, saying in his great address, if America is to become a great nation, not knowing if it would ever keep its promises and become the great nation it's always pretended to be. In Allen Ginsberg and Wichita Vortex Sutra, his great Vietnam-era poem, where he claims the role of prophet and says he doesn't know how to get the voice that he needs, whereas Jello Biafra, Bill Hicks, they knew the answers from top to bottom. There was never any doubt. Jello Biafra in particular, it's a smug voice. It's a condescending voice. And it's not a voice that I've ever wanted to hear.
Grill Marcus, looking for the doubt along with certainty, or maybe instead of. Gene is calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Gene, you're on the air.
Hi. I am really fascinated with your program in that I am a UCC, United Church of Christ mm-hmm. minister, mm-hmm. leading a group studying the Reverend William Sloan Coffin and the public television interview with him entitled The American Prophet.
Yeah.
Now, there is a thinker and believer who also was humble in his assessments, but very outspoken, and I think we ought to refer to William Sloan Coffin if we're going to talk about modern prophecy. He just died, as we know.
Right. Well, he was my college chaplain. We've had him on the show several times before he died. I mean, there's an example of doubt and courage, a believer and a thinker par excellence in many ways. Does he make your screen, Grill Marcus, William Sloan Coffin?
Sure he does.
And in the tradition of, or with what kind of poetic parallel, if there's one to him, or is this in a line of its own?
I think he comes out of the Puritan tradition. I think he comes out of, you know, regardless of his denomination, he comes out of an attempt to link each individual to a social compact so that we are all led and really forced to live up to something greater than ourselves.
Also a liberal voice. I read one reviewer of your work in The Shape of Things to Come asking, Grill Marcus, is there no conservative prophet you're willing to look to describe?
Well, I'll just say that I'm not a partisan person, and so it didn't occur to me that the people I was writing about in this book were from the left or from the right. As a matter of fact, David Lynch, who dominates two chapters of the book, mm-hmm. is a very, very conservative person politically. No question about it.
Simon's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Simon. You're on the air.
I had a comment about a link between Lincoln and Ginsburg, and that's Walt Whitman. And I was wondering your opinions about how much credit we can really give to the prophets for actually making a change. Whitman, for example, had a lot of influence on Ginsburg. Ginsburg was self-consciously imitating that prophetic tone. But how much change did Whitman himself really make? How much change did Ginsburg himself really make? Ginsburg didn't really found the hippie movement, but he really helped usher it. So, you know, how much actual effect does poetry have, and how much is it just recognizing a state and just talking about it?
Of course, recognizing is no small job in itself. Simon, thanks for that. Grill Marcus, how about a change versus illumination? I mean, do you give the poetic prophets credit for change?
You know, I have to give you a terrible answer, which is yes and no, and that is that what the prophet does is try to get people to examine their own place in a greater dilemma, and the prophet can't be concerned as to what the result of that examination might be, if it will be good or ill, depending on how anyone sees it. And yet, at the same time, Allen Ginsberg's great Vietnam-era poem that was composed on the run in Kansas in 1966, in the middle of the war, where he tries to understand what the war is and tries by fiat, by announcement, to end it in that moment, was part of the great chorus of voices and actions that did bring about the end of the war 9 years later.
You know, our time is so short, but I just want to ask you, if you feel American ears wide open to prophecy these days or not. I mean, we always have more or fewer prophets, but what about our readiness to hear prophecy? High, low? Was it ever thus?
I can't answer that question, except I think that when the Lincoln-Douglas debates took place in 1858, then you had the soul of the country up for grabs, and you had two eloquent people arguing with each other over it, and thousands upon thousands of people coming from all over the Midwest to sit there and listen to these two men battle it out. The soul of the nation is up for grabs. Each thinks he knows what it is, and everyone has to make up their own minds.
Well, let us sit on that grass again and pay a lot of attention and listen to the voices where we find them of prophecy. Lord knows we need to figure a few things out here. Grill Marcus, it's a terrific read across an enormous landscape. We're grateful for the new book, The Shape of Things to Come, Prophecy and the American Voice. We're grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We conclude our program with the theme music from David Lynch's Twin Peaks by Angelo Badalamenti. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.